storms that forced her children to entertain themselves indoors. Before the storm passed, all three of them were in timeout. Or maybe the term was trouble now. They were getting too old for the reprimands she knew how to implement. Some fight over the television remote, and she was exhausted. The television screen black. Hadia sent to her room, Huda to hers. Leila's voice hoarse from shouting that this was not appropriate behavior. And Ammar was to sit quietly in the kitchen with her and think about what he had done. How he had thrown the remote at a wall so the battery compartment came loose and the batteries fell out. Huda screamed that he had aimed it at her, while Ammar insisted loudly that he had not. Leila did not know what to do, except to tell them to scatter. Maybe her hold over them was lost, but Rafiq, when he was home, still had his spell that he could conjure just by looking at them, just by sitting in the same room. They listened to him, and were not rude to him, and for whatever reason, they had decided that not only would they not listen to her, but they would be rude too, openly questioning her decisions. Hadia mumbling, "Of course you let Ammar stay downstairs still," and Huda stomping up the stairs after her. Ammar and Leila had stood in the kitchen in silence. Ammar watched the rain hit the window, anger emanating from him like steam rising from a hot mug. Upstairs, either Hadia or Huda slammed her door shut and banged things around in her room to emphasize her frustration. Ammar pointed to the glass and said, "Look, when it rains harder, the drops join together more quickly." She raised her finger to her lips to shush him, but when she turned back to the window, she saw what he meant. She waited for the rain to stop its storming and stepped out into her garden to check on her tomatoes, and the moisture from the damp grass seeped through her sandals. They were fine. Little green tomatoes just beginning to grow. Ammar watched her from behind the sliding door, his face pressed against the glass so his eyebrows looked strange and flattened down. She tried not to smile. He was so alone in their home. Hadia and Huda were ready to comfort each other. Her daughters' faces were not at the window to see her and accuse her of special treatment, so she waved Ammar over. And he came. They walked together, and he followed closely. What did he notice that she didn't? He tugged at a leaf of her basil plant, as if to show her he was angry still, then let go before it snapped, the bush shaking and drops of rainwater flecking out in all directions. Her son knew how to look closely at the rout of rain on glass. She had not taught him this. What could she teach him about how to be in the world other than how to behave? Ammar looked at her in a way that asked, "Have you forgiven me yet?" And because he looked at her in that way, his initial anger replaced by shyness, she knew the power was tilted in her favor, and she could try to extend his guilt, hoping it would make him think twice next time. "You know, Baba would be very angry if he saw what you did today." They didn't care how she was affected. Maybe children could never imagine their mother as being anyone other than their mother. "I already know that." He put his hands in his pockets, then looked up at her from the corner of his eye. "Are you going to tell him?"
"No."
"Will they?" He nodded toward Huda's window. How quickly he separated himself from them. "Maybe if you apologize, they won't." His face soured. What was it about an apology that was so difficult? It always felt like it cost something personal and precious. Only now that she was a mother, was she so aware of this. The stubbornness and pride that came with being human. The desire to be loyal and generous that came too. Each impulse at odds with the other. You have to apologize when you have wronged someone, no matter what, especially if it is your sister's. What more could she say? She felt a consistent tug to give to him, to give to all of them. Sliced apples and time in the sun, a spot in the shade, but something more too. An instruction on how to be in the world. It particularly tugged at her then, watching Amar kneel and pull at another leaf until it tore. The smell of fresh basil. These were their daily battles, and every day there were fallouts, and reparations made by the time Huda asked for salt, and Amar was the first to pass it to her. By the time her girls stumble into her bedroom, they have only 30 minutes left to eat. Leila tells them they have 20, hoping they will eat quickly, then bites her tongue. Her Rosa has not even begun yet, and she has lied. But they never care to feed themselves as much as she cares to feed them. They sit cross-legged on the floor, eyes blinking at nothing, wincing and groaning when she switches on the light.
Hurry and eat,
Rafiq reminds them, and they eat so slowly she cannot believe it.
You didn't wake me,
Amar says from the doorway. There is hurt in his voice. He sounds like a little boy. He rubs his eyelids. One leg of his pajamas has gathered up at his knee. Leila looks to Rafiq. They have not brought up a plate for him. If he is already grumpy from sleep, refusing him will only make him cry. Rafiq looks at him, and then at his watch. Then he taps at the space next to him, grabs another roti, and places it folded on his plate. Pours some of the fried spinach next to his egg. Yawning, Amar enters, and half asleep, he leans against Rafiq as they eat from the same plate. Hadia wakes to the smell of biryani cooking and the news that Mama is throwing her an early birthday party. On Wednesday, she will be 9. Mama presents her with the dress she will wear, an American one that embarrasses Hadia when she sees it dangling from Mama's finger. Mustard yellow, and not at all fashionable, a giant swoop of a skirt that swallows her up and drags past her ankles, puffy sleeves, and a lace collar. Her embarrassment only deepens when she sees Huda wearing the same, only in magenta, a fact that makes Huda spin and say, "Look, we're like twins now." But when Mama beams as she lines the three of them up against the wall, under their old happy birthday sign, Hadia tries to push her disappointment aside and smile for Baba, who twists the camera lens back and forth before photographing them. "You're impossible," Mama says in the bathroom when Hadia asks if she can wear something else. "You complain if I give you Indian clothes. You complain if I get you a dress after you insist on dresses."
"I didn't mean this," she says, her voice low and head bent, speaking into the folds of the skirt.
Mama brushes her hair roughly, pulls her hair into a too tight braid. When she finishes the braid, Mama looks up at Hadia's reflection. The expression on her face softens.
"Your 9th birthday is a very special one," Mama says tenderly.
"Are you ready to start wearing hijab? It's your choice. But you know you are 9 now, and so you should choose soon." Mama wore a scarf whenever they left their house, or whenever a man came to visit. Almost all older girls at mosque wore it. Hadia always thought it was just what would happen to her when she turned 9. Never thought that she would not wear it. She considers both her options. What Mama would think if she wore it? And what Mama would think if she didn't. Hadia is quiet, so Mama continues. "Remember, 9 is the year your record of deeds begins to be kept. You're old enough now to know right from wrong."
"I know that," she says, louder than she intended, and she twists out from beneath Mama's hand on her shoulder. The doorbell rings, and Mama leaves to receive the guests. It is a midday party. Hadia tiptoes to see her reflection in the bathroom mirror. She runs her hand along the ridges of her braid, not a single hair unkempt, and considers untying and untangling it. Mama would be angry, but unable to do anything, because all the aunties and uncles would be watching, and watching her kindly, knowing it was her birthday. Last night, Mama had told them the first part of the story of Prophet Joseph, and it is this story she thinks of as she waits for the last possible second before having to go downstairs. It has always been one of her favorite stories, but Amar, who is 5, hadn't heard it before.
"Why did the brothers throw him into the ditch?" he asked.
"Because they were jealous," Huda said. "And is jealousy a sin?" Mama asked. They all nodded. "What happens when you sin?" Mama asked them. She was always making good stories boring by asking them questions like that after. Questions that made the stories feel less like magic and more like lessons. Amar looked at Hadia to offer an answer, but she had none.
"The angel on your left shoulder writes it down in his notebook," Huda said.
"That is true, but you also get a speck on your heart, a dark, small speck."
"A dark speck?" Amar asked.
"Yes," Mama said, "with every sin. Jealousy is a sin. That's a speck. Lying is a sin. Another speck. Each of them like stains."
"A permanent marker stain?" Amar asked.
He had recently gotten in trouble for using a permanent marker to draw on the window, a stain that had not gone away completely, even after Mama scrubbed. Now he lifted every marker before he used it and asked, "Is this a permanent marker?" "Yes," Mama said as she brushed his hair. "A permanent stain. And with every sin, the heart grows harder and darker, until it is so heavy and black it cannot tell good from evil anymore. It cannot even tell that it wants to be good." All three of them were silent and horrified, until Mama said, "Of course there is always the opportunity of asking Allah for forgiveness. One must be remorseful."
"Resourceful?" Hadia asked.
"No, remorse. Deeply regretting it, and resolving never to do it again." Mama made her hand into a fist and shook it.
"Are the brothers remorseful?" Amar asked.
They had only reached the point of Joseph's brothers throwing him into the ditch, ripping his coat, and covering it with the blood of a sheep, and taking it back to their father. Hadia's favorite part of that story was when Joseph was reunited with his father, but it would probably take 3 nights to reach the end. "They are very ashamed, but it is too late."
"What's ashamed?" Amar asked.
Mama looked up at the ceiling for a moment, as if she were wondering how to answer.
"When you do something you know you shouldn't have, and you are afraid to show your face."
Amar looked down, as if considering Mama's explanation.
"Why is it too late?" Huda asked.
"Nothing can be done. Joseph is gone." There is a knock on the bathroom door, and Huda calls her name. Hadia tells her she's coming. She looks at her reflection, rubs where she imagines her heart to be, and wonders if there will be dark specks inside her heart if she does not wear a scarf after Wednesday. Last night was the first time she heard of the specks collecting like dust on the heart. And if not wearing a scarf was a speck, would a new one bloom every day she chose not to? She weaves through the guests, lifts her cupped hand to her forehead in adab to the uncles seated on the couch, accepts the gifts or envelopes from the aunties with a polite thank you. She watches Huda, standing near the sliding door with some girls her age, telling them about the goodie bags. Huda's hair is cut short, like a boy's. There is an M&M's packet in each one, she hears her say. Huda has a whole year before she has to make any decision, and this feels unfair. She feels apart from all of them. The girls talking about M&M's, and the women wearing dupattas or scarves on their heads, discussing what she does not care about. And she looks past them all, to her plum tree, its pretty purple leaves rustling, its branches swaying slightly, and no one surrounding it or standing beneath its shade. How she likes to sit there and listen to the wind pass through its branches. Some children are playing tag, and others are playing hopscotch on squares drawn with chalk on the cement. Their fingers are dusty, powdery blue and purple. The girls jumping are young. Their hair is worn down, and it lifts up and falls wildly as they hop from square to square. She wishes her mother had told her about the party, so she could have invited her friends, Danielle and Charlotte. But she dismisses that thought as soon as it comes, realizing she would be too embarrassed to wear this dress in front of them, too shy to explain that the dinner is biryani and that there are no games planned, just children released into the yard, and that the adults are all there because it was more a party for them to mingle and less to celebrate her turning 9. What will she have to tell Danielle and Charlotte about wearing a scarf? What are the reasons to wear it, other than that everyone she knows from mosque wears it? And a frightening thought. What if after Wednesday, her friends treat her differently? Will they know that she is the same Hadia, with or without her hair showing? Hadia reaches the plum tree at the far end of the backyard. The only thing beyond it is its own roots and the wooden fence, and she picks at the bark that she loves, picks at it until a small piece breaks off, and she looks at it jagged in her palm, turns it around. There are many trees that she appreciates, but only two in this world she loves, and the plum tree is one of them. She is lucky that the other is in their front yard, the magnolia tree, visible from her bedroom window. The plums are always too high for her, and she remembers when she was little, her father would let her climb onto his back to pluck one. Would he speak to her after Wednesday if she chose not to wear hijab? Happy birthday, Hadia. It is Abbas Ali, the eldest Ali boy. Hadia wraps her hand around the piece of bark. Its rough edges bite. You too, she says. Abbas laughs a little, and she feels silly, realizing her mistake. Hadia looks down at her dress. If it were a yellow crayon in a crayon box, it would be the one that was never used. It would stay sharp and unbroken. That and the gray one. Even the brown would be used before this kind of yellow. Abbas walks up to the plum tree and touches it with his hand also. He is the only other person here her age. She thinks that maybe she should tell him this, and that they can be friends for the duration of the party. Abbas's hair is a little long for a boy's. It falls in his face and covers the tops of his ears. If she started to wear a scarf, he would never see her hair again. Danielle and Charlotte might still, when they were in the bathroom at school, or if they came to her house. But Abbas is a boy who is not related to her, and so he would never. This is my favorite tree, she tells him. Abbas looks up at it, and Hadia looks up too. Past the branches and the leaves and the little plums, straight to the bright sky. She squints.
Because the leaves are kind of purple?
No. Just because. Abbas nods. They stand side by side. They watch children playing freeze tag, standing still, shocked expressions on their faces, arms stretched out and waiting for someone to tap their fingers. Maybe if she started wearing a scarf, she would grow up right away. Maybe she would not be able to run at a party like this one. No boy would be able to touch her to unfreeze her or tag her. And she thinks of how, sometimes when they go to Seema Auntie's house, they all play soccer in the backyard, because the Ali family has 2 soccer goalposts, and Abbas always invites her to play. And she does play, even though she's not very good. But at least she is getting better, according to him. The last time they played was at his brother Saif's birthday, and there was a jumpy castle too, and a popcorn machine. And it is when she is looking at Abbas in his green t-shirt that she thinks, I will not be able to play soccer anymore. Not with him, anyway. And I won't get any better than scoring 1 goal in the last 5 minutes of our last game.
Why aren't you happy if it's your party?
Of course, he is her friend. The wind blows, and the branches move, and make their wind and leaves sounds. And Hadia's dirty yellow dress fills up with air, and she holds it down with her hands. Even her lace collar flares up. Someone opens the door, and it is one of the uncles, holding a folded white cloth, which means the men are going to gather on the lawn and pray soon. I didn't know I was going to have one, she confesses. And once she does, it is easy to say, I don't know if I will like being 9. And I don't like this dress. Abbas is quiet. He stretches for a plum, but he is too short. His fingers are inches away from the nearest branch, the plum hanging. Hadia is grateful he does not try jumping up and down to reach it, drawing attention to them and kicking up dirt. She wants to suggest climbing onto his back and reaching up. But that is forbidden. She knows that. She wonders what the size of the black mark on her heart would be if she did, and if it is worse than jealousy, worse than telling a lie. The uncle is trying to put the white sheet down, but it keeps lifting in the wind.
Why not? You look like the sun.
She smiles for the first time that day. Baba barks her name in his angry voice, then says nothing after. He begins walking across the lawn to them. She looks at Abbas and remembers why they are not friends. Not really. Maybe they are acquaintances. The word Baba uses when he tells her, remember, boys are not your friends. They are acquaintances when you are in the classroom, and you have to keep your distance. Abbas walks away without saying anything, becomes one of the children running, lifts his baby sister in his arms. His shirt is the kind of green that would get used a lot.
Ji Baba,
she uses her almost childlike voice. The little piece of bark cuts into her palm. She drops it into the dirt when he looks like he's a little bit mad at her. She rubs her reddened palm with her thumb.
Why aren't you playing with the other girls? He asks.
They aren't my friends.
The uncle silences the children, points to the house, and they begin to march inside. The older boys linger, knowing it is time to pray soon. Baba puts his hand on her head, and his hand has a weight to it, and Hadia tiptoes up to him a little to feel the pressure. She wants to say to him, remember when I climbed on your back and plucked the plums? But before she can, he reaches up, wraps his hand around one, and tugs, the whole branch bending a bit before his hand returns with a small, deep purple plum. He hands it to her.
Thank you, Baba, she mumbles. And for the party, too.
He nods. They both turn to the men who have spread out the white cloth. Men are gathering in a row on the grass. She knows Baba will leave soon, walk up to take his place in the prayer line. As if he can hear her thoughts, he says to her,
now you have to start praying too.
Hadia looks up at him. She senses that he's proud. When she is standing next to Baba, she thinks that she is ready for it all. He places his hand back on her head, and she moves the plum from hand to hand, feeling its weight.
Baba? Do you think I should start wearing a scarf? A man begins reciting the adhan. She sees that Abbas Ali has found a spot in the line. Even though he does not have to. He is 9'2", but won't have to start praying until he is 15. He will never have to wear a scarf. They are so lucky. She wonders if seeing him there makes his parents happy. And if God has an opposite of a dark spot on the heart if someone does something good, like a shimmer of gold. The wind makes small ripples in his green shirt. Baba is silent for the duration of the adhan. Then the man is finished, and Hadia knows there is a small slot of time before the second call, which calls Baba to come to pray. When Baba speaks, he does so slowly, as if he is being very careful about every word.
I think that you should. It would be good if you did. And it is wajib on you now, you know. It would be a sin not to. But it is your decision.
She looks up at him, dark from the sunlight behind him. She does not squint, does not blink, reaches up to tug at the little tail of her hair that is not woven tight in a braid, the soft clump, like a paintbrush, bristly at its edges. He opens his door to his father's face and knows immediately that something terrible has happened. Rain pounds the roof, wind rattles the windows. An unexpected storm that was light drizzle just an hour ago. Hadia is still home on her break from college, and the three of them are staying up late, reading together. He's afraid to ask what is wrong. His father's face is pale, his expression unfamiliarly softened. He is fully dressed in a button-up shirt and pants, even though it is well past 1 in the morning, and he had retired hours earlier.
"The Ali boy," his father begins,
but a break in his voice stops him from continuing. Everyone called the Ali boys, the eldest Ali boy, the skinny Ali boy, the youngest Ali boy. To Ammar, the Ali boys were just Abbas and Abbas's younger brothers, and their sister Amira Ali, who was perhaps the only child in their entire community known by her full name. No one needed any other marker to distinguish her. She was already herself, even as a child. He knew he was referred to as Rafiq's boy, and when he was younger, the community members would add, "that naughty one."
"Which one?"
It is Hadia who asks. They both turn to look at her, as if noticing her for the first time, and the look on her face makes Ammar's mouth suddenly dry.
"The eldest one," his father says. "A car accident."
"Abbas?" Ammar asks, and Baba nods. And next to him, Ammar hears Hadia make a small animal sound. He leans against his doorframe. Then somehow he is sitting. Somehow his hands are flat against the rough carpet. His father is saying, "I'm sorry." "But he's alive?" Ammar thinks he asks, but his father doesn't reply. And anyway, he already knows. His first absolutely stupid thought is to wonder who he will sit next to at mosque now. And just as the possibility of loss begins to open up beneath him, he thinks of Amira. Her note is hidden in the side pocket of his history notebook. He has hesitated from tucking it into his keepsake box, because then his box would become not where he stored his own journals, but where he hid that one reminder of her. He has composed a dozen letters to her in the 4 days since receiving it, but has discarded them all. He feels a sudden urge to be beside her, and he's surprised by his thoughts, by the way they pull him in her direction. His father says he's going to the Ali house. His voice so thin, it sounds nothing like him. When someone passed away in their community, people gathered in the house of the bereaved every day until the funeral. They brought food,
sat in circles, read prayers and passages from holy texts, dedicated the merits to the deceased.
I'm coming too, Hadia says.
Unnecessary, his father says to her. It is late and inappropriate.
I'm coming, she says, a determination in her voice that Amar had not expected her to ever use against their father.
She looks up at the ceiling, holds tight onto her own arm.
I want to see Amira,
she insists, expressing the very thought that had become a beat in Amar's mind. Their father, worn out by the news, does not have the energy to deny her.
Outside, raindrops darken their clothes. His father turns to Amar, as if he is about to say something, but touches his shoulder instead, just for a moment, before retracting his hand to unlock the car door. Amar does not flinch at his touch.
You're distracted, Abbas had said to him the last time he saw him alive, 4 days ago at the jashan Mama had thrown for Hadia.
They were standing in the food line together. And it was true. Amar was distracted, and more reserved because of it. After years of not having anything to hide from Abbas, he was embarrassed to find that his first secret was about Abbas's younger sister. When Amar gave him a flimsy excuse as to why he would not join him for a smoke walk, Abbas looked at him skeptically, a look that Amar recalls so vividly now. It sickens him. But Abbas shrugged, talked more to make up for Amar's silence, and instead of asking someone else to accompany him, he stayed by Amar's side. Now there would never be another walk to the corner and back, a moment as simple as looking at him and then the sky. Abbas was young, Hadia's age. Amar is afraid he will throw up, or worse, cry. So he tries not to think of the way Abbas gave him a reason to be excited about being a member of their community. Or that time when Amar, Abbas, and Abbas's brothers, Saif and Kumail, passed a joint around for the first time, the windows open, fan on, candles and incense burning. Abbas made him feel that he had a brother, as though that bond was possible for him. At school, Amar was valued for the very qualities that were looked down upon in his house. There he was not disrespectful, but funny. There, it was good that he was interested in English class, in the poems and stories his teachers assigned. As far as he was aware, none of his school friends knew what it was like to come home to a house that was quiet the way his was, where everything was forbidden to them, loud music or talking back, wearing shirts with band logos printed on them. A father who yelled, a mother who looked out the window or spent the day praying and tending her garden. A family that wanted him to change who he was, to become a respectable man who obeyed his father's every word and followed every command given by his father's God. Or what it was like to live with the knowledge that his father would disown him if he found something as harmless as a packet of cigarettes under his mattress. To not have that kind of love. To not even believe in it. But Abbas knew these things. They would leave the mosque to walk in the parking lot, talking about what Amar could never voice to anyone else. The streetlights reflected in the murky puddles, and Amar confessing he did want to believe in God, in his father's God. And he was afraid to lose that desire. Abbas touching his shoulder to stop him from stepping into a deep puddle, telling him,
"You know, just because you don't listen doesn't mean you don't believe."
Abbas knew when to stop fighting with his parents, and how to guard the secrets that would hurt them, and in turn cause him to be hurt by their rejection of him. He did not resent that this was the way it had to be. But Amar could not do that without feeling like a hypocrite. And now Amar pulls the seatbelt away from him because it feels too tight. He bites on his knuckle, afraid to think of who he has lost. the one person in front of whom he could sin under the watch of their father's God without being cast aside. His father has forgotten to turn the wipers on, and neither Hadia nor Amar reminds him. Drops of water gather on the windshield when the car slows to stop at a red light, and each drop has caught within it the color red. He turns to Hadia in the back seat. She leans her head against the car door and looks out the window. When the car trembles, so does she. She refuses to meet his eyes, even though she knows he is looking at her. He has always prided himself on being able to discern how Hadia is feeling by studying the look on her face, the way she carries herself, what she does not say. But tonight it is impossible to make sense of her. Abbas's street is filled with parked cars. It seems news has reached every community member. This is a tragedy, he thinks, as he steps out of the car and the door slams behind him. Tonight, they have all lost a young man, barely 21. This night, he knows, will be a mark that divides his life. They are soaked by the time they enter the house, which is warm from the people that will continue to visit in shifts. It is sickening to think of Abbas as a body to be buried. The first room, the family room, is full of women. Amira is not there, but Abbas's mother, Seema Aunty, is surrounded by women who are speaking to her as if she were a child, hugging her to offer their condolences, and she collapses into their embraces, each one making her cry anew. He is hit with the strange sensation that Seema Aunty has comforted him before, that he has felt safe in this very room, and he is not sure if it is from a memory or a dream. He cannot look at her. Women sit in clusters reading from the Quran. Hadia takes a seat in the corner by herself, without reaching for one of the books. The look on her face unsettles him, a vacancy to her expression that makes him want to shake her. He turns away and follows his father into the men's section. He tells his father he will be right back. His father nods and continues on without him. The Ali house is grand and beautiful, and Amar knows every corridor. All that playing hide-and-seek in the dark, even now he could close his eyes and find his way. The corridor to his right has a staircase that leads upstairs, one used only by the Ali family. He stands at the foot of the staircase. Behind him, he hears murmurs, no one wanting to speak loudly in a house of mourning. It is a risk to walk upstairs, an even greater risk to walk straight down the hall to her bedroom and knock on her door, and perhaps there would be nothing more shameful for the two of them than if they were caught, speaking alone in an empty bedroom. But this is his life. This is exactly what he wants to do with it. He walks straight to the door he's known for years was hers, and feels his knuckles touch it for the first time. An entire minute passes. He turns twice to look at the empty hallway behind him, afraid to hear any approaching footsteps. Then the door opens, just enough to reveal her face. Then a little more. This, that she opened the door wider upon seeing his face, feels like an accomplishment. His chest pinches when he sees the way crying has exhausted her features. He feels guilty for his quickening heartbeat, guilty for how aware he is that they're alone. She steps back from the door, giving him a space to enter, and he does. I couldn't be downstairs, she confesses, as though they were already friends. She speaks in a voice unlike the one he remembers. Too many people. No one who really knew him. He wondered on the drive how they would address what had happened. And now he sees it is as easy as saying, knew instead of no. Her eyes, rimmed red, are a shocking green. He takes in the little details of her bedroom. A wide bed by the window, the curtains open, the vicious downpour of rain outside. Her walls have been painted a robin's egg blue. There is a white desk beside him, and on it, a framed photograph that looks like it has been set down where it does not belong. He lifts it. It is a picture of the four of them, Abbas, Saif, Kumail, and her. Abbas's smiling face is young, and Ammar remembers that was the year they had all gone camping with the mosque group, and he and Abbas had taken a walk without turning on their flashlights. They thought that was courage. They stood in the center of a dark trail and listened to the sounds of the night, the pattern of the spaces between leaves that moonlight made on the path, the force of the wind through all those trees. He feels sick, almost dizzy, but tries to compose himself. He has not come to be comforted. "It's from Kumail's birthday," she says, and he realizes he has not looked up from the photograph. Her voice is soft. She continues, "That night we all went out to dinner. Just the four of us. Abbas Bhai had just gotten his first job, and he was eager to pay." "That sandwich shop," he says. Abbas had only worked there for 7 months, but he bragged about his skills for years to come, made them sandwiches when they were hanging out. "It was exciting because our parents weren't there, because we were doing something sort of grown-up for once. At least, that is why I was excited. I don't think they would have included me if it hadn't been Kumail's birthday." She does not look away from his face when she speaks to him.
"That's not true," he tries.
She smiles, very slightly, as though she had not wanted to. It falls from her face quickly. She bites her lip, then releases it. The door behind him is all but closed. They are so alone. Even if they spoke in hushed voices, anyone standing outside would be able to hear them. And if he knows it, so must she. But still, she does not ask him to step away.
"This was the year we
broke the kitchen window?" She half smiles again.
"I was going to say, all went to the camp."
She was right. That year, he kicked the soccer ball so hard, the kitchen window shattered. The four of them, Kumail, Abbas, Saif, Ammar, stared at the space where the glass had been for a good minute, until Seema Aunty's shocked face appeared there. And even when she began yelling, none of them blamed him.
"You didn't come back for weeks after that," she says.
Ammar feels so shy that she remembers he cannot think of anything to say.
"I got your note," he finally speaks.
She frowns slightly, and he wonders if it was a mistake to bring it up.
"Out of everyone, I was hoping you would come," she says.
She might be the bravest person he has ever met, saying what she thinks and feels without fear or hesitation. She adds, "You were one of his closest friends. He would have wanted you here." Abbas gone, and never coming back. Her voice is so sad, it makes him want to touch her. It seems wholly unbelievable that they are not allowed to touch one another, that he cannot even offer an embrace to comfort her. How could something so simple, for the sake of solace in a time like this, be a sin? Her hair falls in her face and covers a corner of her eye. It suits her. What doesn't suit her? But her eyes are so beautiful, he wants to move her hair, just to look upon their full effect. He looks to the ceiling, clenches his hand into fists.
"He loved you a lot,"
he says, his words sounding foolish, so predictable as soon as they are spoken. But it was true. One of the reasons Amar loved and respected Abbas was because of the way he spoke about the people he loved.
And he spoke of you often, he tries again. More than the rest of them.
That seems to make her smile. And this time, she lets it stay. 4. Leila had thought the separation from her family would be harder to bear. But when she steps from the plane into the airport for her layover, she only worries for her father, waiting for her in a hospital in Hyderabad. In this airport, she is someone without anyone, without Rafiq, without her children. And it is refreshing, lonely in a way that being alone in her room is not. I am Leila, she thinks, as she drags her carry-on through the airport, studies the screen that displays the departures and arrivals, stops to purchase gum, and finds her gate without asking anyone. And as she watches the slowly moving planes make their way across the tarmac, she feels a strengthening in her aloneness, a comfort in knowing she can rely on herself. It is also comforting to realize herself unwitnessed is in harmony with herself seen, that she discreetly does the minimal wudu in the bathroom, seeks out a room in the airport where she can pray, that despite the fact that no one would know if she skipped her prayers and slept as she wanted to, she unfolds a napkin on the floor, sets down a small sajdaga, and prays. And as she lifts her cupped hands in prayer, she recalls Amar's question from months ago. Do you pray for yourself and God, or do you pray because you're told to? And before she dismisses the thought, she thinks, now she could answer Amar with honesty. I pray for myself and for God, who is my witness. 3 days ago, her father had a heart attack while Leila was dropping her kids off at school. She came home to an empty house, and the answering machine light flashing red, a message from Sara at a moment when their father's recovery was unpredictable.
You should go, Rafiq said on the phone, before she even finished explaining what had happened.
The tickets, she said, thinking of how expensive they were. The reason she had not made many trips back in the past, and never on a whim. Always it was her parents who would come and stay with them for months. They gave Leila company in the daytime, and on the weekends, the whole family would take trips to see the Golden Gate Bridge or the Mystery Spot. They were planning on coming for Hadia's high school graduation at the end of the school year, and Leila called them every week to remind them to book their tickets, that Americans took graduations very seriously, and that it would mean a lot to Hadia if they came.
It does not matter, Rafiq said, dismissing her concern. He is your father.
She was grateful his first response was to suggest exactly what she needed and wanted to do. But who would drop off and pick up the children? School had begun just a week earlier. It was still early in September. Amar was in 7th grade now and had joined the soccer team, wanting a break from basketball. Huda was a junior, and Hadia was 18 and in her senior year. Leila had never left the three of them in the house alone for more than a few hours. Her girls never cooked the meals she made, but experiments they pulled from cookbooks. And Amar fought with them often, which always angered Rafiq. And perhaps her biggest worry of all was that she could not trust Amar and Rafiq to be left in the same room alone for too long.
Leila, we will take care of it. I will cancel my work trip next week, Rafiq said, when she asked him how they would manage.
Her tickets were booked before Rafiq returned home from work, and Leila swelled with love for him, her love born from gratitude. When it is time to board the plane to Hyderabad, She steps inside with her right foot first. As she walks down the aisle, she looks at each seat number to make sure it is not her own, clutching her purse and passport in her hands. And it is Oliver Hansen she thinks she sees, Amar's teacher from years ago, tucking his bag beneath the seat before him and sitting up to buckle his belt. But of course it is not him. It surprises her. Who returns in thought when one is so far from familiar life? She finds her place, recites her prayers, and soon feels the mighty force of the plane take off from the runway, pushing her back into her seat. 4 years ago, Amar was in the third grade for the second time, and finally flourishing. Layla was grateful for two things that year. The first was that Mark had continued to be his friend, despite the new grade gap between them. She felt for her son, who watched his classmates move on to another classroom, eat during a different lunchtime, open a new set of textbooks. Still, Mark remained loyal, and Layla loved him for it. Layla became friends with Mark's mother, Michelle, an articulate woman with a closet full of bright dresses and matching shoes, and a soft-spoken demeanor that was so different from her rambunctious son's. At Christmas, Layla would gift Michelle a box of chocolates, a video game for Mark, and write their family a small card that Hadia checked over for her. Michelle waited in the kitchen when she came to pick up Mark, and while the boys finished up their games or begged for 5 minutes more, Layla made her tea the way she liked it, without carnation milk and without any sugar. And the two of them spoke of the boys' antics. Or Michelle, who had no daughters, asked about Hadia and Huda, and complimented Layla on having raised daughters who were sweet and polite. Even Rafiq, who was hesitant when it came to school friends, suggested inviting Mark if they were going to get pizza or going to the movies, knowing how excited Amar would be to call and ask. The second thing she was grateful for that year was Amar's third-grade teacher, Mr. Hansen, a young man who had just left graduate school. Amar spoke endlessly at dinner about Mr. Hansen. He recounted what Mr. Hansen had taught him, or what joke he had made, even if it was not funny when repeated, or would announce to everyone if a movie came on television and Amar happened to know it was Mr. Hansen's favorite.
"Can we hear about something else, Amar?" Rafiq half-joked one night.
But later, when the children got up to clear the table, Layla gently reminded him. "He's excited about school for once. Let's be grateful." Excited about school, and responsible too. For the first time, he had been the one to remind them of the parent-teacher meeting. Rafiq sighed. They always went together. They listened to the complaints in silence. Layla would nod, look around the room, and try to picture her son there, scan the little desks, and wonder which one was Amar's.
"I can't skip work that day," Rafiq said.
"He's doing well this year," Layla said. "I can go alone." The lights in the classroom were off, a purple tint, some of the curtains drawn. It was late afternoon. Amar was to wait for her on the picnic table outside, and she made him promise 3 times he would not budge from it. He asked her to take him to get ice cream if he kept his promise, regardless of the news she received in the meeting, and because she was 3 minutes away from being late, she agreed. It had been years since he and Hadia and Huda had been in the same school, and still, she felt the loss of that change. How comforted she would be when she said goodbye to them in the morning and watched the three of them trudge off, knowing that at least when they left her sight, they would be near one another. How would she present herself? What would she say? Sometimes when in public she was so shy, others assumed she did not speak English, and they would ask Rafiq or Hadia to ask her something, and she would feel deeply embarrassed, too embarrassed to respond fluently in English as she knew how to. Mr. Hansen was sitting at his desk, his head bent, hands busy shuffling papers, and she could see his light brown hair had been neatly combed, and that he had worn a tie. She knocked beneath the light switches, and his head jerked up, and she asked, "Mr. Hansen?" and felt the questions she had prepared during the drive over leave her. He was so very young. Why had she come without Rafiq, who always knew what to say?
"Please, call me Oliver," he said,
and he stood with his hand resting at the center of his tie. It was red, with three navy blue stripes at the bottom. He didn't offer a hand to shake, and she was grateful. He gestured at the open seat across from him and waited to sit until she took her place.
"So you're Amar's mother," he said, smiling,
and Leila felt relief, a smile there instead of a concerned look, which she was so used to from Amar's teachers, who were careful with their words, perhaps out of fear of hurting her. His jittery excitement allowed Leila's own nerves to relax. "Leila," she said, touching her own chest, and realizing for the first time that giving a name was its own kind of intimacy.
"Your son might be my favorite of them. I know that isn't something I should say. He's in here at lunch sometimes. I give him books to read. We discuss."
"Very kind of you. He has a hard time. He doesn't like school very much."
Oliver nodded, then said, "Certain kids you have to learn how to teach. Amar is like that. You have to know how to approach him. What to say that will ignite his curiosity, his wonderment. He doesn't really respond to criticism, and he doesn't try at all if he doesn't want to. But if he thinks he can do something well, or if he wants to, he does. You just have to be patient, a little delicate."
Leila wished she had brought a notebook that she could write in to help her remember what he was saying to show Rafiq later. She glanced around the room, at the whiteboard with a chore chart corner, at Amar's name written in uppercase beside paper passer, and the wall covered with sloppy paintings of faces under self-portraits, the rows of empty desks.
"That one is his," Oliver said, pointing to the desk in the second row.
It was not as messy as some of the ones around it, with bent papers sticking out of the built-in shelves. To be patient with him, to be delicate, to know how to approach him, to be patient, to know how to make him curious, to criticize less, to be delicate. She asked Oliver if Amar was caught up with the other children in math, history, sciences.
"He's very good at writing. Look, here is an assignment we did on heroes."
He passed her a sheet of paper with a photograph attached with a paperclip. She was startled to see the photograph was of her, holding an open envelope, young. She was not wearing a scarf. Rafiq had taken it when they were first married. She stared at a version of herself with dark eyeliner rimming her eyes and dangling golden earrings, and her ink-black wavy hair, and her fitted pink shalwar kameez. She remembered how she did not know Rafiq was standing in the doorway with his camera until he called her name, and when she looked up, he had clicked. There was an expression of surprise on her face, her mouth a little open, barely a smile, but the hint of one. That was the year his camera was always pointed at her, if he brought it down from the high shelf where he kept it, a year before Hadia was born, and the only photographs of her became ones where she was holding their children. She did not know what album this photo was in, or how Amar had found it, or what had possessed him to bring it to class without asking her first. "I didn't know he had taken it," was all she could think to say, and she looked up at Oliver, watching her, his face full of pride that confused her, as though he were the one proud of Amar and not she. She was suddenly embarrassed he had seen her without her scarf, or a younger version of herself, and then wondered If the woman who entered his classroom with her face aged and hair covered disappointed him somehow.
You can take the project with you. It may not seem like much.